Good evening. British prosecutors spar with defense witnesses in the extradition trial of Julian Assange. Bill Barr likens the coronavirus lockdowns to slavery, and school opening is delayed in New York City as taxi drivers rally and Occupy Wall Street marks its 9th anniversary. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Thursday, September 17th, 2020. A federal judge on Thursday temporarily blocked the United States Postal Service from making operational changes that states say threaten the timely delivery of election mail. U.S. District Judge Stanley Bastian in Yakima, Washington, said he would issue a nationwide preliminary injunction sought by 14 states in a case brought against President Donald Trump, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, and U.S. Postal Service. And the U.S. Postal Service over the changes which were made in July. The states won almost all their demands. Led by Washington, they asked that all election mail be treated as first-class mail, regardless of the paid postage, that sorting machines that had been removed be replaced. Donald Trump's re-election campaign on Thursday denied a Guardian newspaper report in which a former model accused the New York real estate developer of sexually assaulting and groping her at the United States Open tennis tournament in 1997. Amy Doris told the paper in an exclusive interview that Trump assaulted her outside a bathroom in his VIP box at the tournament that year. She was 24 at the time. Doris was quoted as saying, "He just shoved his tongue down my throat and I was pushing him off. And that's when his grip became tighter and his hands were very gropey and all over my butt, my breasts, my back, everything." The newspaper published photos that it said were provided by Doris showing her with Trump and said that it interviewed several people who Doris confided in at the time of the incident. And federal prosecutors said on Thursday they had filed additional charges against Lev Parnas, a one-time associate of President Donald Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who was already facing campaign finance-related charges. Prosecutors said they had now charged Parnas and an associate, David Correa, with conspiring to defraud investors in an insurance company they operated. And two more defense witnesses appeared on Wednesday for the trial of Julian Assange. The co-founder of the Iraqi Body Count, which documented civilian deaths during the Iraq War, which began in 2003, and a lawyer specializing in human rights and constitutional law. Rebecca Miles has been following the hearing and files this report.
Wednesday morning opened with testimony from Professor John Saboda, co-founder of the Iraq Body Count. He told the court how the website, supported by the Oxford Research Group, documented civilian deaths in Iraq. Saboda was asked about the value of incidents in the Iraq war logs obtained by WikiLeaks. He said they supplemented the work they'd already been doing, collecting data from public sources, but was also a record of U.S. military patrols in the streets in every area of Iraq, and included details on deaths, injuries, sometimes with the name of victims translated from Arabic to English, sometimes with coordinates, and far more information from news reports. Saboda said his partner developed a software program using an English dictionary to assist in redacting any words that were not English and then refining the program to include professions and locations. The process took weeks to develop but was effective. During cross-examination, the prosecutor made much of Saboda's lack of formal authority to examine the documents and the lack of vetting process to become involved in the journalistic work. It had been a tactic of the prosecutor to question the validity of witnesses. The court turned in the afternoon with Carrie Schenkman, a constitutional lawyer who focuses on human rights and First Amendment rights. He had spent the last 6 years studying the history of the Espionage Act. Schenkman was asked about how broad was the Espionage Act. He explained that it was born out of a series of First Amendment repressions because President Wilson wanted the U.S. to join World War I in Europe. During cross-examination, Schenkman was badgered about his involvement with Assange and whether he'd represented Assange when he was working in the office of Michael Ratner. "I was in a food chain of lawyers, but I was plankton. Ratner was a distinguished constitutional lawyer." Tomorrow we'll complete Schenkman's testimony. Rebecca Miles, WBAI Pacifica Radio, New York.
Rebecca Miles has been covering the extradition trial of Julian Assange for WBAI. And President Trump gave a speech at a White House history conference where he likened attempts to teach lessons on slavery and white privilege in the nation's schools to siding with America's enemies.
Students in our universities are inundated with critical race theory. This is a Marxist doctrine holding that America is a wicked and racist nation, that even young children are complicit in oppression, and that our entire society must be radically transformed.
And that's President Trump. Attorney General Bill Barr, speaking at a Constitution Day celebration hosted by Hillsdale College, compared the measures to control the spread of the coronavirus to slavery.
Putting a national lockdown, stay-at-home orders, is like house arrest. It's you know, other than slavery, which was a different kind of restraint, this is the greatest intrusion on civil liberties in American history.
Attorney General Barr, the Attorney General's comments earned a sharp rebuke from House Majority Whip James Clyburn.
Slavery was not about saving lives. It was about devaluing lives. This pandemic is a threat to human life. And the experts, the medical experts, the scientists, are telling us what it takes to respond successfully to this pandemic. And if this administration, this god-awful duo of Trump and Barr, they're going about the business of doing what's necessary to protect the people of this great country, we would be beyond this pandemic by now. Those countries that did it, they are beyond it. Those of us who ignored it, it would be great. It would have been great if we had a national lockdown so that people's lives would be saved and our children would be going on with their lives today as they should be. But that is just what we're up against here. Two people in charge of running the law enforcement of this country are absolutely tone deaf to what it takes to be great leaders.
And as the House Majority Whip James Clyburn mentioned, there has been no national lockdown related to the coronavirus in the United States. An attorney and former judge, Bill Blum, is author of the article, "Our Attorney General, Bill Barr, is an Authoritarian and Religious Fanatic," at buzzflash.com. He says Barr is no longer making law, but has become a would-be authoritarian.
I don't know Bill Barr personally, but he sounds like someone who's gone off the rails. Unlike Donald Trump, who thrives on chaos and has this oppositional personality, I wonder whether Bill Barr isn't having some sort of a mental issue, a la Michael Caputo, the guy from HHS, who is a longtime Trump and Rod Stone crony, who just yesterday took a leave of absence because of mental health stress problems. He doesn't sound like he's all there anymore, Bill Barr. When he was first nominated, saw him as a conservative, to be sure, not a friend of progressives, but as someone who wouldn't drive a purely Trump agenda once he became attorney general. But they have been proven wrong, and I don't know where or when Bill Barr is going to stop.
Is this because of Trump, or just this is like people who just think that politics makes it okay to do anything you want to win?
It's unclear to me. Bill Barr, prior to taking on this recent stint as attorney general, wasn't known as a political figure. If you consider the unitary executive theory that Bill Barr promotes for Donald Trump, he also has that kind of idea as to himself as attorney general. He said recently that he's the attorney general. He gets to determine who gets prosecuted, and all of these underlings have to follow his lead, as though they swear an oath of loyalty to the attorney general. They don't. They swear an oath of loyalty to the Constitution. I'm very concerned about this guy. He's talking about using the Sedition Act to prosecute protesters. And as I said, I don't know where all this ends, except perhaps with his prosecution, should Joe Biden win the election and should someone with some kind of fortitude become the next attorney general. Bill Barr is a real danger to the Constitution, in my view. He has assumed for himself Trumpian delusions of grandeur for the position of Attorney General. It seems as though Bill Barr has been infected with this view espoused by Donald Trump, and that Bill Barr really now is an authoritarian. He's an authoritarian and he's a theocrat, as I wrote recently in a syndicated column. If you look at some of Barr's speeches on Christianity, he comes very close to promoting a state religion.
He's taken Christianity in a very crazy direction.
Exactly, he has. He's taken it in an authoritarian direction where he's flirting with theocracy. It's one thing to say everyone has the right to freely worship as they please, but it's another thing to start saying or hinting that there should be an established faith in the United States. And Bill Barr loves to talk about the founding fathers. He thinks of himself as something of a historian, and he's trying to anchor his authoritarian views in the views of the founders. Every time he goes out on another limb, I just wonder when that branch is going to crack and fall.
Attorney and former judge Bill Blum is author of the article, Our Attorney General Bill Barr is an Authoritarian and Religious Fanatic, at buzzflash.com. The unitary executive theory says the president has singular power above the other branches of government. American history is replete with authoritarian acts aimed at advocates for justice and social change. Historically, the FBI has kept files on a variety of targets because of their political message. One of the groups that were in the crosshairs have been folk musicians. Aaron Leonard is author of a newly published book, The Folk Singers and the Bureau, The FBI, The Folk Artists, and the Suppression of the Communist Party USA from 1939 to 1956. He says support for worker and racial justice was all the FBI needed to launch an investigation.
The Communist Party, its supporters, the union people, held a concert for Paul Robeson at the end of the summer. And, you know, the FBI was more sitting on the sidelines, maybe stoking the fires, you know, in an individual way. But the American Legion and various right-wing forces organized a huge protest against Peekskill. And it was a combination of anti-communism, anti-Semitism, and racism. I mean, it's crude. I mean, you can actually watch clips of it on YouTube. But it's very interesting to see the confluence of the matter of ethnicity and race and these radical politics all kind of cohere into one. It reads as very contemporary.
Right.
You know, there's an ugliness.
Yeah, the ugliness. I wanted to focus on that for a second, the ugliness, because isn't that a fight between intellectuals and non-intellectual people, really, what was going on here?
Globally, communism was actually quite ascendant. They had a lot of prestige and power, and not being uncritical of the Soviet Union when I say that, it's just a fact. China would soon become a socialist/communist country. One-third of the world people were living under this system, and the United States was very defensive. And part of that defensiveness is, you know, the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow was thrown in their face by these new societies, you know, correctly so. Like, you claim to be this great democracy, and you've got a whole section of your people, you know, held in bondage. The fact that all these artists kind of concentrated a strata of people other than the white Christian nation is emblematic of some things, certainly.
Were the Weavers the most important as far as starting this?
I think the Almanac Singers back in 1941 with Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, Millard Lampel, who went on to write for television, and Lee Hayes. And they started excavating all these folk songs, but they were a very partisan group. The Weavers started more in 49, and for a while they were close to the Communist Party, but then they went mainstream and went popular. And then they were denounced by this FBI informant, Harvey Mattuso. Between 1950 and 1952, the Weavers were the top of the charts with songs like Good Night, Irene, Kisses Sweeter Than Wine, Sloop John B.
people listen to punk now, or they listen to what they like to listen to nowadays. They think that's radical. But back then, a softer sound with meaningful lyrics was considered radical.
Exactly. You can watch a video of them doing Goodnight Irene, and Lee Hayes holds up a picture of Huddy Ledbetter, who had popularized this song, and he gives a little testimonial of Leadbelly, who is an African-American man who came out of the prison system in Louisiana and came north and produced this really great music. You know, Leadbelly is somebody that George Harrison said, look, if there wasn't a Leadbelly, there wouldn't have been Rock Island Line by Lonnie Donegan. And if there wasn't a Rock Island Line by Lonnie Donegan, there would have been no Beatles.
This was really cutting edge stuff at its time. And why did the government see this as a threat? And what did they do to these people?
Because organizationally, these folks were affiliated with the Communist Party at one point or another. And if you didn't publicly denounce it, they kept your file open. So Woody Guthrie's file stays open until, you know, after he's dead, and they're actively investigating him in 61, 62, when he's in the grip of Huntington's Korea. If you were associated with the Communist Party, you were an enemy of the United States.
Were they frustrated, the government?
I think it's a real problem. They cannot have these figures in the public square doing these kind of things. You saw the same thing when the Dixie Chicks came out against the Iraq War. Even more recently, when Beyonce had the audacity to use the imagery of the Black Panther Party at the Super Bowl, a section of the status quo said, no, we're not comfortable with this at all, and we're going to close it down. People listen to artists. Artists are hugely influential, and if they're pushing something the status quo doesn't like, they need to be shut down.
Aaron Leonard is author of a newly published book, The Folk Singers in the Bureau, The FBI, The Folk Artists, and the Suppression of the Communist Party USA from 1939 to 1956. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In-person reopening in New York City public schools are being pushed back more than a week under a last-minute plan Mayor Bill de Blasio and union leaders rolled out Thursday amid concerns that there are not enough teachers to accommodate students.
So here is the updated approach we will take, and it involves several phases. They move quickly, and therefore we'll be able to serve children and families well. But they will include some adjustments compared to the previous schedule. So here's what we'll do. Beginning this Monday, September 21st, 3K and pre-K early education sites will be open. Pre-K and 3K classrooms will be open. District 75 schools, schools that serve our special education kids, kids who need a lot of support and love, those schools will be open. We then will have the next phase on Tuesday, September 29th, when K through 5 schools and K through 8 schools will open. And then on Thursday, October 1st, middle schools and high schools will open. Now, this means the in-person learning. Obviously, remote learning has begun already. The orientations have begun. Remote learning will continue throughout for all students as these phases come into play. But again, September 21st, this coming Monday, 3K, pre-K, special ed. And then that means District 75. Then on Tuesday, September 29th, K to 5 and K to 8 schools. Thursday, October 1st, middle schools and high schools.
Mayor Bill de Blasio, the mayor, says he'll be adding 4,500 new teaching spots to help. The latest sudden change in the city's back-to-school plans comes after weeks of union leaders sounding the alarm over staffing shortages. UFT head Michael Mulgrew says the snow day emergency method used by schools are not adequate in the time of COVID-19.
One of the things that every school has is what's known as basically a snow day scenario, when there'll be a number of children but a lot of staff, or when you don't have enough staff to deal with the number of children, you put children in large gatherings and put teachers in front of them. When it became apparent the snow day scenario cannot be used in the pandemic, you cannot put large numbers of children in a room, in an auditorium. Therefore, you had to have a teacher in front of every classroom. When the mayor saw that it was clear at that moment, he said, then this is not acceptable. We are not going to let children and schools be put in that position. So we have to figure out how we're going to get to a better place, because this is not acceptable. And that's really what happened at that moment. And that was something that we have an understanding of how the schools actually operate and all of their resiliencies and contingency strategies that they have. And some of those tools are being taken away from them because of the pandemic. Then we have to recognize that we have to figure out a different way to help and support them, because they don't have the tools that they always had in terms of emergencies and things that pop up.
UFT head Michael Mulgrew: de Blasio would not guarantee that there would not be further adjustments to the in-person education plan. And New York taxi drivers shut down traffic on the iconic Brooklyn Bridge on September 17th to demand Mayor Bill de Blasio provide help as the steep drop-off in ridership caused by COVID-19 continued to impact the industry. WBAI was at Wall Street this morning where the cabs lined up.
If you've ever had a job and you go home at night and your back aches from working, then you understand the pain of a cab driver. If you ever had a job that didn't pay you enough money to keep up with your bills, then you understand the pain of a cab driver. If you ever took out a loan where the bank cheated you and preyed on you, then you understand the pain of the cab driver. If you worked day and night to serve this city and all you got was silence from the city, then you understand the pain of the cab driver. If you came to this country from another country to find a better job, a better life, then you understand the plight of the cab driver. Fellow New Yorkers, we are you. If we, the people, don't stand up for each other, they're going to crush us. That's why we're out here on the streets. These streets, fellow New Yorkers, they were paved with the blood and the sweat and the tears of cabbies. So we've come here to say to you, stand with us, stand with the people, stand with the workers, stand with the people, stand with the workers, stand with the people, stand with the workers, stand with the workers, not the bankers, stand with the workers, not the bankers. Children,
we are here today because we're struggling.
You're a cab driver.
Yes, I'm the cab driver and the medallion owner.
What's wrong? What's happening?
What happened in the city was selling the medallion very expensive. Now they are giving the medallion cheaper. And because of the Uber, they let it. And then everything is dropped. And it's not fair. All the law making on the taxi limousine commission for the taxis. Now Uber is not even limousine company taking over our business. That's why we are here.
What do you want to see happen?
What we want to happen, they bring some organization to fix this situation. This is not fair for 100 years serving yellow cab in New York City, now putting out the business.
Where are you from originally?
I'm from Turkey.
Today we came for forgiveness. For
that time they sold the medallion $1 million. Now this medallion is like $50,000 in the market, Bangladesh.
And the demonstration, organized by the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, called for debt forgiveness for cab drivers. And finally, today was the 9th anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, the movement for economic justice that took over Zuccotti Park, a short distance from Wall Street, for 2 months. A small group of veterans from the occupation.
I think it's important for all of us to talk about how much Occupy influenced us. One of the most important things that happened with Occupy is it actually normalized protest. Protest is normal, and I think that's a beautiful thing.
With the Black Lives Matter movement, the new and long overdue American Revolution, with nearly 5% of the population, 15 million people in the streets, and the terrible martyrdom of the innocent brothers and sisters who unintentionally gave their lives to inspire us, nature and human nature simply cannot sustain evil forever. We live in a crippled country, fraught with conflict, ravaged by fire, by storms and by an ill-handled plague, a crashing economy and a torn social fabric. Yet we still love it and cling to our tattered dream of democracy.
Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter! Bill de Blasio was trying to always please the police department. And one of the things that happened to him is the police department, as you know, never, never, never liked him. He tried to please them, and they still didn't like him. He tried to please them again, and they still didn't like him. So now, what is the problem? That the city, the people in the city don't like Bill de Blasio. People are on the street, sleeping all over the city, camping. Viva Occupy!
I ended up in the shelter system for 8 years and 3 months. Even though my situation has improved so much through a lot of work and testifying before city council, there is so much more to do, because it's all about giving the landlords the profits. The landlords making, as long as we have a system that's designed to benefit the wealthy, like the landlords, we have a problem. So we need to keep fighting.
Black Lives Matter. There's a lot happening around the country. The Black Lives Matter movement, as a result of who's been killed, murdered by these racist police. And it goes on and on and on. And that's why we are here today, to commemorate the 9th anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. And in this very spot where we are standing, we know what happened. 9 years ago, we know. We took over this damn park. Yes, we did. And we shut it down. Just last week, we shut down the George Washington Bridge. Right, yes, we did. And we had support coming from New Jersey as well. Yeah. Occupy, shut it down.
Do you want a Green New Deal?
Yes.
Do you want out of debt?
Yes.
Do you want universal basic income?
Yes.
Do you want universal health care?
Yes.
To fight this pandemic? Do you want a job guarantee?
Yes.
Do we want new jobs, creating a green new national infrastructure and transportation infrastructure?
Yes.
Do you want reparations for victims of colonialism
yes.
and slavery?
Yes.
And that's Occupy Wall Street, marking its 9th anniversary today at Zuccotti Park. Some of the news for Thursday, September 17, 2020. The news was engineered, was produced with Rebecca Miles and Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.